from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. This week's Washington visit by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu began with protests across the U.S. this weekend and an appearance before the pro-Israel lobbying group AIPAC. We begin with this report from Press TV's Caleb Maupin, who was in New York for one of the protests.
Heavy wind and snowfall did not deter a crowd of protesters who gathered to denounce the upcoming speech to the U.S. Congress by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The protesters assembled outside the headquarters of News Corporation, the owners of Fox and Sky News. Civil rights organizer Larry Holmes of the People's Power Assembly described Netanyahu and his message as racist.
It's an insult to every decent, freedom-loving person on the planet. It's spitting in our face because his message is war on the oppressed, especially if you're Arab, if you're African, if you're Asian, if you're Muslim. Genocidal war on you. And he's coming to Washington to make this message.
Many protesters carried Palestinian flags and described Netanyahu and Israel as illegitimate.
And Netanyahu represents the extreme right wing of the Zionist movement. And we want to, you know, just send a message to him that he's not welcome here.
Labor activist John Fletcher said the speech fits into the Republican Party's pattern of hostility to Iran.
The Republicans are obviously trying to undermine Obama's negotiations with Iran, and I think they're, you know, really trying to prepare a campaign for war against Iran.
Many New Yorkers who observed the protest were sympathetic. Brooklyn resident Ian Costello, who passed the protesters on the way to a job interview, said he agreed that the upcoming speech was highly offensive.
I think that his invitation by Boehner directly undermines our president in a truthfully disrespectful way.
Among the protesters were Iranian Americans, anti-Israeli Jews, Palestinians, leftists, and peace activists. The protest continued for 3 hours despite the hostile weather conditions. Caleb Maupin, Press TV, New York.
Netanyahu is seeking to scuttle any possible deal between the U.S. and Iran in the face of negotiations between the so-called P5 plus one and the Islamic Republic. RT's Paula Slyer reports from Tel Aviv.
Netanyahu might be on American soil, but the two leaders won't be meeting. U.S. President Barack Obama won't be dealing with the Israeli premier. Not that they liked each other to begin with.
We have a prime minister that is a Republican in his body and soul.
And when the Republican Congress invited the Republican senator from Israel, as some inside Israel jokingly referred to Netanyahu, they bypassed the American president. Party politics at its best.
The Republicans are using it to try to beat the Democrats over the head.
For Netanyahu, it's a photo op just 2 weeks before his country's elections.
On the surface, Netanyahu wants to warn Washington about Iran's nuclear program. But many fear Netanyahu's also playing a game with U.S. domestic politics to undermine and pressure Obama into changing his foreign policy.
Obama wants to give negotiations a chance, but Netanyahu believes the deal on the table will allow Tehran within a year to create the bomb. American-Israeli relations are at a new low.
They have very, very different ways of looking at the world. For President Obama, his formative experience was working in Chicago as a community organizer, having an optimistic view of the way human beings can respond to change. For Benjamin Netanyahu, one of his formative experiences was sitting on his father's lap and having his father tell him about the evils of the Spanish Inquisition.
And ever since, Netanyahu has earned his place as Israel's doomsday leader.
And it's then that the Ayatollahs will show their true face and unleash their aggressive fanaticism on the entire world.
Not all Israelis support their prime minister's heavy-handedness, while at the same time, 3 in 4 Israelis don't trust Obama to stop Iranian nukes.
I think this Iran agreement that they're working on right now would be very difficult to undo and can lead to really very bad, harmful consequences.
But thanks to the political wrangling and point scoring, Israel might just find itself without its closest ally in preparing for what Netanyahu believes might just be its biggest test.
But the negotiations with Iran and its president, Hassan Rouhani, continue, and, according to last year's agreement, should lead to the lifting of anti-Iran sanctions. We have more from Press TV.
President Hassan Rouhani says a nuclear deal with P5+1 must include the lifting of all anti-Iran sanctions. Rouhani says the sanctions have harmed all sides in recent years, including the EU. The Iranian president stressed his country has always met its commitments in the nuclear negotiations. He added that everybody has realized the fact that Tehran has been a serious party in the talks. The president was speaking with the Italian foreign minister, Paolo Gentiloni, in Tehran. Gentiloni agreed that the sanctions must be removed in a nuclear deal between Iran and the P5+1. He said despite the sanctions, there are numerous capacities for cooperation between Tehran and Rome. Let's speak to Kaveh Afrasiabi. He's an author and political scientist, and he joins us from Boston. Many thanks for joining us. Now, it seems that looking at the words of Iranian diplomats, the issue of sanctions is one that seems to be a sticking point when it comes to the negotiations with the P5+1. Why do you think that the West is so insistent on not removing the sanctions altogether?
Well, you know, there's been good progress made at these last rounds of negotiations, and as you just said, most likely this is one of the final remaining glitches before a final nuclear deal is signed, hopefully in the very near future. What President Rouhani has said is simply a reiteration of what has been stated in the Geneva Interim Agreement with respect to the removal, not the suspension, not the freezing, but the removal of all the sanctions that have been imposed on Iran as a result of the nuclear standoff. So the other side, the Western parties involved in these talks, need to abide by their own agreement in the Geneva Agreement that stipulates the final deal whereby all these sanctions would be removed. And so President Rouhani is presenting a very rational and prudent approach to this problem that serves the other side's interests as well, because the European and American firms are being hurt as a result of these sanctions, and billions of dollars of potential trade have been lost, and these companies have been deprived of enjoying the fruits of global marketplace as a result of these coercive sanctions. So I think that the approach that has been presented by the Iranian side is very reasonable, and we have heard from the Italian foreign minister echoing that sentiment, which I think represents a broader consensus in the international community.
Right. Now, another fan of these sanctions against Iran is Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Let's not forget his address to Congress is coming up fast. Despite the criticism of Democratic leaders like Senator Dianne Feinstein and even veterans within Israel who have said that Netanyahu should not be delivering the speech. However, what kind of effects do you think that speech can have on any potential agreement?
I think very minimal, hardly any. There's a very good likelihood that this speech will backfire on his presenter, Mr. Netanyahu, and will hurt him in the election process that's coming up in Israel. So Mr. Netanyahu is doing his political opponents a service by coming to Washington and giving a speech that is not liked and welcomed by the White House and many members of the U.S. Congress itself, and we've heard some 2 dozen members who have already said they're going to boycott the talk. And I think that the most likely outcome of this speech will be negative for Mr. Netanyahu and the neocon hawkish politicians and pundits in the United States.
Greece's leftist Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras has accused political leaders in Spain and Portugal of a conspiracy to topple his anti-austerity government. Press TV's Marzia Hashimi has more.
Well, Greece's leftist Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras claims that Madrid and Lisbon fear their own radical forces before elections in the two countries later this year. Tsipras also rejected the criticism that his government has backed down from its anti-austerity position to secure an extension of its financial lifeline from the eurozone. He says anger among German conservatives shows that Athens has won concessions. Berlin is the largest contributor to Athens' 240 billion euro bailout. Greece has been grappling with its worst debt crisis since World War II.
Early last week, dozens of protesters clashed with police in central Athens, smashing shop windows and burning cars in opposition to the deal to extend the bailout program by 4 months. That deal has also triggered dissent within the governing party. But many in the know say that the temporary deal is nothing more than a postponement of the inevitable, an acknowledgement that the austerity model is not working and that a solution must be found to the underlying economic problems facing Greece and the EU. Among those is Jiang Songju, head of the Agricultural Bank of China, who was featured in an interview last week by China's CCTV news agency.
I'm very pessimistic about the solution of Greece's debt problem. The extension of 4 months is just space of breathing time. It's not solution of a problem. It's too short. 4 months is too short to implement the promised reforming measures. Greece needs longer term, even 4 years, to implement the promised policies, the fiscal reform, employment, opening markets, taxation system, reshaping. All these measures are very difficult. And 4 years ago, 3 years ago, 2 years ago, the Greek government promised to do that. But now they ask desperately for extension of bailout.
So you're saying there's only a breathing room. In fact, nothing will be done.
Nothing will be done.
Significantly. Yeah.
The motive behind Friday night's killing of a Russian political figure in Moscow has become the focus of international speculation and media attention. We begin with this report from RT's Kevin Owen.
The killing sparked worldwide reaction, as we've been saying. Barack Obama said the US condemns the brutal murder. German Chancellor echoed that as well, saying she was appalled, while the French president called it a hateful killing. There's been comment too from Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron, calling for a rapid and transparent probe into what he called a callous murder. Let's talk now to political commentator Anna Vandensky, joining us on the line. Hi, Anna. Nice to see you. I mean, several media, as we've been saying there around the world, have been linking this death directly to the Kremlin. Before I come to you to get your thoughts on that, I'm sure you have many, let's just take a look at what some of the mainstream media has been saying a second.
Opposition leader and outspoken critic of President Vladimir Putin has been shot dead in central Moscow.
Critics of the government, critics of Putin, bad things seem to happen to them.
He worried about his own safety for good reason, and yet he kept his voice up. This is a dangerous thing to do in Russia.
So, were those comments justified or not, Anna?
Well, I think that, first of all, we should realize that Mr. Nemtsov was a politician. So by definition, it's a political assassination because he was an opposition politician. And I read it and I feel it that it's an act of political terror. And in this way, we have to be very, very careful. It means the only reaction, the only ethical and correct reaction of a political class in Russia and worldwide can to be very distant it and not draw any political consequences of this murder, because this assassination is meant to disturb. This assassination is meant to create trouble. And if politicians in Russia or worldwide would start playing the blame game, putting it on President Putin or any other political force in Russia, it means the assassins would succeed.
He was certainly a known figure in the 1990s, much less so lately, certainly as far as power and influence was concerned. But what impact will his passing have on Russia?
Well, I think that he's a very colorful politician. He has always been. I was fortunate to meet him in person, and he always made these dynamic or enthusiastic appearances. But I think that, of course, he's a figure very much of the past, and his brightest days and his most interesting moments are related to Yeltsin era. But it doesn't mean that, of course, it makes the crime less abhorrent, because any politician is valuable, and any crime against any politician in the world, I mean, that there should be no difference as President Kennedy or a politician of Yeltsin era, any politician should count on condemnation of this act and on strong support of his community and electorate against these apparent crimes.
Russia's President Vladimir Putin has ordered the Russian Investigative Committee, the Interior Ministry, and the Federal Security Service to set up an investigative team to investigate the murder. Investigators were said to be considering several crime scenarios, some of them linking the murder to events in Ukraine, the Charlie Hebdo terrorist attack in Paris, and Nemtsov's business activities. And although the U.S. media was quick to put the blame on Putin for his killing, even top opposition figures have pointed out that the killing is not in Putin's political interest. Former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev said the killing was aimed at destabilizing the situation in the country and at heightening tensions with the West. In a statement, Gorbachev said, quote, "The assassination of Boris Nemtsov is an attempt to complicate the situation in the country, even to destabilize it by ratcheting up tensions between the government and the opposition," closed quote. On June 14, 2012, Lorenzo Johnson, whose wrongful conviction for murder was finally overturned by a federal court, turned himself in to go back to prison, again serving out a sentence of life without parole for a murder in 1995 that he insists he did not commit. After serving more than 15 years of his sentence, with a trail of paper and proceedings through both the state and federal court systems, Johnson's claim of innocence was accepted by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, which decided that the state had failed to prove his guilt and ordered him released. After his release, his case went before the U.S. Supreme Court, which ordered him back to prison. In this second installment of the investigation into his case, we spoke with Lorenzo Johnson this past Sunday about some of the details of the decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to reinstate his conviction, which returned him to prison. It appears that the appeal, the federal appeals court that dismissed your case, when it was reversed by the U.S. Supreme Court, they did it because essentially the Supreme Court has a policy, the law has a policy of giving deference to juries who get to see the witnesses. They make an evaluation of whether they're lying or not. You know, there's things, it's almost like they look at the courts as Monday morning quarterbacking, and so they give wide deference to the jury in a decision. Exactly. And so what happens here is, in the process of filing the follow-up to the U.S. Supreme Court decision, after you filed a couple of supplements to your original petition to be released, they come upon a 10-page, single-typed document that was never disclosed to your lawyers that essentially impeaches. It's from the primary witness that was at issue in front of the Supreme Court, and it essentially contradicts every one of the points that the Supreme Court relied upon. So
exactly.
So talk to me about it.
Well, you know, with them withholding that evidence, you got to look at it from this aspect. You know, they knowingly and intentionally let false testimony go from the beginning of the stages, from my preliminary hearing, from the trial, to my direct appeal, to my post-conviction relief appeal, to my...
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
My federal appeal, all the way up to the United States Supreme Court, they let judges adapt false testimony when they had in their possession the correct testimony. So they knew that this was false, and they let it go all the way up to this aspect, and not once did they step in and say, wait a minute, this can't stand, that's not the truth that was said, that was not in the affidavit. But we never knew this until a couple months ago, 19 years later, that, you know, what was said at trial was contrary to what was said in the original statement, because we never got the statement from this witness.
So, and like one of the key points, for example, supposedly... you are an accomplice. The guy who shot the decedent, the victim, was accused and charged with the actual killing. You and he and the victim go into an alleyway, and one of the key points is whether or not you went in behind him and, you know, were intimidating him or forcing him into the alleyway, and that would make you an accomplice. And And she testified to that effect in court. But as it turns out, in her written statement, in the statement that she made in front of the police prior to her testimony, she said that it was not the case, that you all just walked in there willingly.
Exactly. It's like another thing about the alleyway, right? And I'm going to send you pictures about
this call is subject to recording and monitoring.
The crime scene pictures. This crime never occurred in the alleyway. And I never knew this until I got the pictures of the crime scene, because it was like row houses, and it's like a porch with two steps, in between two steps, like almost onto the sidewalk. And it's a fence. It's a 6-foot fence that was chain locked, that you have to jump over this fence to get in this alleyway. But they just kept pushing the story about an alleyway, and in reality, this murder never took place in the alleyway.
And you were out of state anyway, which is another point.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
The police, they intimidated a female that I was with at the time, that if she come forward, that they was going to take her kids and stop, don't try to help me. And she told them, you can check my phone records, that, he called me from New York around this time, that he wasn't here. She knew that I was, I was staying with her. She knew that I wasn't, in Pennsylvania at the time. And the police chased her away with other witnesses that they intimidated. And it came out of trial that this took place because one of the lead detectives, he came to the prison because one of my witnesses was incarcerated. He came and got him in prison after he made his initial statement and brought him to the police station and said, your story's not matching with the other story, the other witness that got this testifying to what I need them to testify, so you must change this unless you never go home. And this all came out of trial, but it was pushed, it was pushed under the rug.
So, and there are 5 points like this that would show that everything, basically every point that they had her testify to, it turned out she had contradicted herself in a statement that the police had and that the DA had.
Exactly.
So why would they do this? I mean, they had the guy who supposedly killed her, or so they thought and so they proved. So what did they need you for?
What it was, I didn't cooperate with them. They wanted me, to lie on my co-defendant and to take a 5 to 10 year sentence for a crime I didn't have nothing to do with. And when I didn't work with them, that's when they told me, oh, you in some trouble. And then all of a sudden, everything they could do as far as bringing witnesses in, changing their statements, giving them deals to testify, this was being taken place on this case. And I didn't have the representation at that time, to counter all this. And at that time, I'm illiterate to the law, so everything they're saying is flying over my head.
Right. And, of course, how much does a criminal defense for a murder trial cost?
And, my trial attorney... My trial was in 97. I was incarcerated since December 95. My trial attorney, this was her first homicide case, and she just came out of law school in 1994.
Ooh. Ouch. Mm. And, of course, to do an investigation, a multi-state investigation, to find witnesses that could place you in New York, to find all of these things, costs money.
Exactly. Mm. And, they had eyewitnesses that was identifying other people who supposed to have committed this crime, got in an unmarked police car, pointed the people out that they saw do this homicide, and police never locked these people up.
Do you think maybe the reason that they convicted you and your co-defendant was because they're covering for somebody else?
Exactly. It's like, we were from New York, and, this detective didn't like people from New York, so, and it's all up and down the record about that. And, we was the four guys.
Mm. Do you have any idea who... Well, we won't go there. Okay, so for this week also, could you tell us exactly where the case is at and what's going to be happening in the next couple of months?
Okay, well, we're in front of my trial judge. He still sits on the stand. And we got the appeals and the appeal been pending since August 5th, 2013. It had 3 settlements with all new evidence, and now we found our reply this Friday to the prosecution's reply, and their whole reply is that they had an open file policy that, the first 8 pages that they hid from us in my discovery to find out that this witness did make a statement.
Right.
We just got our hands on it a couple months ago, and now, we got My prior attorneys were shown this statement, and they said they never saw this before. This is the first time they've seen this. This is 19 years later. Yeah. And they saying they could have used this to impeach this witness because what was said at trial was contrary to what was said in the statement. So we filed our reply on March 6th. It's due.
So, and what this hangs on, basically, is the question of whether this is new evidence. In other words, they never gave it to you before, and so now you have a...
They never turned it over.
Right, and they're saying, yes, we did. We had it was available to...
No, they didn't say they turned it over.
No, they said it was available.
They said it was an open file policy, and that, you know, we could have found this out sooner. No, we can't find it out sooner if you hid this evidence.
Right.
Because if you look at the record, every witness that testified, their statement was admitted into evidence to the jury, to the court. This statement was never introduced, and we got the paper of everything that was introduced. This was not introduced.
Was there a transmittal letter over the materials the DA sent to your lawyer that said, in reply to your request for all of our documents, here's what we send you? Is there something like that there?
Yeah, they sent the letter. They sent the letter stating that, okay, we're going to turn this stuff over to you because you said your file doesn't have all of this stuff, but we're not agreeing for you to file any further appeals.
No, I'm talking about originally, when in the original trial, when you made a demand for disclosure and they transmitted the disclosure, was there a cover letter that said, here's everything we got?
Yeah, it's a cover. I have the cover letter, and the cover letter does not have the statement.
Oh, so they left it open so that if something was discovered later, they could say, well, you didn't ask for it.
Exactly, but we asked for everything material. And this is
crazy
right here, as far as withholding evidence, you know.
That shows innocence.
That can show a different outcome.
Right. And so now the question may well be, well, first, either the question at the bar is whether they withheld it and consequently now it can be considered. And if not that, the question becomes, well, it shows I'm innocent regardless of the paperwork issues. I'm innocent. Shouldn't I be let out? Is that where we're at?
Exactly. And, you know, the whole thing about this is everything as a whole shows my innocence and supports my corruption claims. And, like, there's no way around it, so they would try to keep me out of the courtroom. But, like, even the attorneys is now signed affidavits saying that they never had this and they would have used it at trial to impeach this witness. So all that about, because when they responded to my appeal after 2 years of delays and said, you know, that it was my fault that I didn't find this information sooner and that I didn't have any signed statements from my prior attorney saying this. Now that I have that, so I want to know what they're going to say now.
And March 6th, what happens?
March 6th is we file our reply to their reply that they just filed.
Okay, and then what?
And then we'll be waiting for a hearing from the trial judge. Hopefully he just grants a new trial right away. But, you know, in this situation, as we know, with wrongful convictions, it tends to drag out. Like, I'm at the 19-year mark. I was already let out once due to insufficient evidence, which barred a retrial. And now we found out the evidence that was used was fabricated. So I would like to see what turn it's going to take now.
Okay. Anything else you want to let people know this week?
Oh, I would like people, you know, to learn more, to go to my website, FreeLorenzoJohnson.org, and sign my freedom petition and, you know, stay involved, you know, write about it, speak about it, you know, and get involved in what's going on. I'm just one of many.
We will continue to discuss this case in depth over the next few weeks with Lorenzo Johnson from the Frackville, Pennsylvania prison where he is currently held.
This is Stephanie Frederick reporting live from inside the Federal Lock 'em Down Bureau. This just in, there's been a massive uprising in the country's penitentiaries. Now to our confidential sources on the inside.
They said they taking our money, got us appealing. I can't keep it down in my heart. I know they nothing but racist. No more pistols to pull, no more corners to turn. I learned all I can learn without being burned. Penitentiary dreams got people mouths on my screens. Cause things didn't go the way that it seemed. Look at you see, dollar bills is all my homies have seen. I guess the devil was the guy to influence the dude to see the beast. Incarcerated for murders that been committed. But when I meet the judge, they act.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.